Football Weekly.
It's a brand new week, listeners, and like Kate Winslet and Danny Boyle, pod listeners everywhere have their very own shiny little bronzed bald figure to cherish. AC Jimbo, back at the controls of Football Weekly. And on today's Zero Gravity etc. agenda, Big Cup, La Coppa con Arecchi, The Mushroom. Call it what you will, but the Champions League is back in action, with the last 16 featuring some very saucy matchups. Arsenal-Roma, Chelsea-Juventus, Manchester United-Inter, the biggest clashes of English and Italian since those press conferences Claudio Ranieri used to do at Chelsea. That's not all. There's Real Madrid-Liverpool and Dr. Sid on a truly remarkable weekend in the Liga. There's Raphael Honigstein, or more munch and misery than lentil day in the Guardian canteen. And slipping through the net somehow, there's gasps championship news too. All that plus assorted posts and other miscellanea on Football Weekly. Hello all. On board today's extra-size Football Weekly, Barry Glendenning.
Hello.
Hi, Barry, you've been away.
Well, I haven't. I've just not been here.
All right. Well, that...
Not, I wasn't as away as you were.
Right, that is true. John Ashdown.
Hi, James.
Hi, John, from the Guardian's football, crack football team.
Absolutely.
Yeah, indeed so. And Paolo Bandini there.
Hello.
Standing by to tell us all about the week's Anglo-Italian clashes. Raphael Honigstein.
Hello.
Hi, Raphael. Thanks. You were in last week, weren't you? Many, many thanks to Ken Early, filling in for a pod superstar. Is always a controversial business, but I'm going to give it my best shot as I retake the controls and stuff. But it's always difficult. Many thanks to Ken, who I thought did a splendid job, despite some were in favour, some against.
Many were against, but what else would you expect from them? They're a very hard to please bunch.
Right.
Very conservative, our listeners. They don't like change.
Yeah.
There was talk of...
Next time, maybe change should come from the barrel of a gun rather than courtesy of a long-haired blonde spectacles.
Barry, are you saying we should put Jimbo down?
No, I'm saying if...
possibly. I'm still slightly haunted by the image of pod listeners clasping a sort of tan Jimbo to their chest and weeping a la an Oscar-winning actress.
Did she cry?
I don't know, but they do, don't they?
That's the general thing.
Has that ever happened to you, James?
What? Cry?
You've just been out in... No, have you been ever...
Clasped
as
by a woman
as a woman
cried?
Ever clasped to her chest and wept?
Yeah, I've been in that.
I'd say quite recently, the wake of your skiing holiday.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, there was some unfortunate aftermath on the piece, yes.
Yes.
let's say that Arteta isn't the only one out for the season with the ligament damage.
Ouch.
Mrs. Jimbo, this one goes out to you. I just wanted to say that there's been some people say, oh, the worst pod ever, which I think is ridiculous. Barry, you and I were putting our heads together earlier. We came up with two.
Yes, but I think there was one I can't remember because I was slightly tired and emotional while recording it.
Yeah, you were completely... I have to say, it was a very impressive evening because when you turned up at the bar, you couldn't stand up, let alone speak. And when the red light went on, you somehow pulled it together. And the even more impressive thing was when the red light went off again at the end, you went out drinking all night.
I don't remember that bit.
No, I bet you don't. But there you go.
That was your fault for abandoning me and leaving me to my own devices, which is bound to end in tears.
Yeah, well, there was another...
And there was another one where...
Yeah, when I came back, I hadn't slept properly, and I didn't have quite your capacity for holding it together. But anyway, listen, let's move on. This weekend in the Premier League, all sorts of interesting things. Arsenal notching up another goalless draw. Gus Hiddink getting off to a winning start with Chelsea. Everton suffering perhaps the one injury that even David Moyes can't work his way around, and that's Mikel Arteta, as I mentioned, out for the season. And, of course, Manchester United conceding their first goal in a very, very long time, but still extending their lead, thanks to Liverpool dropping yet more points at home. Next up for Manchester United... Of course, at San Siro, are Inter Milan, coached by Sir Alex's old nemesis, Jose Mourinho, and Paolo Bandini. Tell us, are Inter going to be able to offer more of a challenge than United's Premier League rivals?
Well, he's not his nemesis anymore. I think Alex Ferguson said he wants Jose back in the Premier League, is what he's been saying now over the last couple of days, which I'm sure is all just part of the... fabled mind games, which we all know by now, obviously makes the crucial difference in every game. Sir Alex Ferguson takes charge off. But You know, it's interesting. Like, it really feels to me like suddenly everyone really actually almost expects Inter to win. There's like a massive section of the public who suddenly think, oh, you know, Man United are going to be missing defenders. They're going to have to play Carrick at centre-back. Surely Inter are going to win this one. It's kind of gone full circle from a point where I thought, oh, well, you know, they might just win this one. But now everyone seems to be so going the other way that I'm beginning to doubt that. Inter are playing well at the moment. They're doing... you know, they're playing it like a Mourinho team. I mean, in that they're not necessarily playing beautiful football all the time, but they are playing efficient football. They didn't give their best showing of the season this weekend against Bologna, but they had that sort of typical reaction where they went to goal up and, you know, they seemed to be cruising, and they did, you know, take their foot off the pedal a little. As soon as they conceded the goal, though, it was a matter of, you know, minutes before they were back ahead again. Mourinho bringing on Balotelli, which he hasn't done in a while. You know, he's sort of bringing him back into the fold, which may be an important moment. And he whipped in this free kick that probably should have been dealt with, but I think it was just the way they reacted was sort of very, you know, it was reminiscent of those strong Mourinho teams you remember when he was at Chelsea, where, you know, sometimes they would have a setback, sometimes a team would score against them, but as soon as they did, you just sort of expected them to come straight back, and that's what they did against Bologna.
He's been big on this business of the players going out to enjoy themselves, playing without fear, etc. But for him, this is a massive game. He's been brought in to win the Champions League, the one thing that they've completely screwed up on since 1965, of course. All the previous poor performances were always filed away, or at least explained away by him, with the notion that his team was being prepared to be physically at their peak at this point of the season. Only for one, don't see them getting past a Man United side who I think have been coasting almost in the Premier League. They've always got that extra gear to go to.
I think what's interesting about this about Mourinho, the way he's sort of been personally coming into this game, is that if you remember a few weeks back, earlier in the season, he was actually being very critical of his players a lot of the time. He was actually very down on his players, and publicly in a sort of, you know, really sort of banging on at them kind of way. And the last few weeks, he's really sort of turned that around, and suddenly he's sort of really sort of giving them confidence, bigging them up, saying, oh, we're going to win this game, talking about, you know, focusing only on the positives. And, you know, even with that aspect of bringing Balotelli back, that's sort of almost a byproduct of that, is that sort of just generally trying to boost everyone up again.
Well, there you go then. Inter are going to be hosting Manchester United. Also on Tuesday, Arsenal are hosting Roma. Big news here from Roma's point of view is the fact that Francesco Totti will be playing. He's been in and out all season. They had a 1-0 win against Siena, unremarkably enough, at the weekend after a poor recent run of results. Arsenal, meanwhile...
I wouldn't say Roma had been that poor. I mean, they got hammered by Atalanta, but before that, they were playing very well.
On a frozen pitch. Yes, indeed.
And Atalanta, a good team at home.
Where they are. Fair point. Lots of injuries and people absent in the weekend. Are they going to have, what kind of side are they going to have to put up at the Emirates?
It looks to me like this is going to be a pretty strong team for Roma. I mean, players missing at the weekend, both Perotta and De Rossi were out suspended rather than injured, so you know, they should be back. And then you've got Vucinic was out but has said he's going to be playing this weekend. I think it'll be quite a strong Roma team. I mean, I think you might be missing Aquilani. I'm not sure about his status for the game ahead, but I think you'll be pretty close to their strongest 11.
Whereas Arsenal, of course, won't be able to field Andrei Arshavin, who is cup-tied. They're coming off the third consecutive goalless draw in the Premier League.
It could be the sort of game that ends up being a pretty dull affair. With Arsenal, obviously, one goal in the last five league games, and that was the last-minute equaliser at Everton. And Roma, here's a stat for you. 23 shots on target in the Champions League so far, which is the fewest of any of the 16 sides to qualify for the knockout stage.
Really? Isn't that surprising?
That is quite surprising, yeah. That's Roma rather than Arsenal.
Yeah.
Problem with Roma is you look at their squad and there are a couple of really sort of players who stand out, like Totti and De Rossi, but there are players like Baptista, and you look at him and you think, well, he's doing well in Serie A, but, you know, he's been at Arsenal and he couldn't really cut it in the Premier League, so... Well,
He feels that his success now at Roma is down to playing in the right position.
Which I understand, and I think that certainly you know, the coach Spalletti's, you know, given him confidence there and sort of backed him in a way that maybe Wenger didn't. But he actually did have some games in that position, and I think that Baptista maybe is one of those players who appreciates that or takes advantage of maybe the slightly slower pace of the game in Italy, which I think you won't necessarily get in a game against Arsenal, and. I don't know. I think there are certain reasons there to not be utterly convinced by Roma, but, you know, at the same time, there are lots of reasons not to be convinced by Arsenal at the moment. I don't think either of these teams is going to win the Champions League at the end of the day. So, I, you know, in that regard, you might say it's it, I don't view it as big a game as Inter United, and I don't view it as necessarily as big a game as Chelsea Juventus, because I think those are teams who are more likely to kick on and make something of it in the grander scheme.
Chelsea Juventus, you mentioned. Now, Raphael, you're very familiar with the goings-on there in Chobham. And what's the mood like now that Gus Hiddink has arrived?
Well, I think most of the players are very happy that they've got someone who has a reputation for his tactical expertise, someone who's really done it on many levels. Just the problem with Scolari was always that he came and he was exposed as a national team manager, which surprised many people because he was been around so long. But the fact that he hadn't been in club training for 7 years somehow showed with Hiddink. He's been in and out, mixing up jobs all the time. He's been coaching everywhere. So I think there was a sense that he is a sort of a safe pair of hands. And, you know, I think a couple of weeks ago, a couple of months ago, I would have said, I make Juventus favourites. But the way they've fallen apart a little bit in Serie A would lead me to believe that Chelsea actually have a good chance, especially now that with Scolari, a lot of the uncertainty, a lot of the unhappiness has gone. You know, in football teams, you have this air of negativity that clings to certain managers once they lose the trust, or once they not necessarily lose the dressing room, but sort of people beginning to doubt in their own decision, in the manager's decision, and that affects the whole team. And I think that seems to be gone. And, you know, just the way they put themselves about a little bit more makes a big difference for a team like Chelsea, who always have to play with force and determination to get a result.
Although there was a moment in this season where Claudio Ranieri seemed to have exactly that kind of black cloud hanging over him, and he responded brilliantly in the Champions League, beating Real Madrid twice. Mm. And they come into this game fresh from a 2-0 victory away to Palermo, which is not an easy thing to get.
Yeah, well, I mean, the funny thing with Juventus is that they, before Palermo, which is a good result, you know, only I think the third team to win in this season, and, you know, aside from that, Palermo had won 9 times at home. But the funny thing about Juventus is that actually, you know, 4 points in 4 games before this weekend, and then this weekend they fielded a weakened side because they were so concerned about the Champions League coming up, and their weakened side went out and won. I mean, I guess the big positive coming out of the weekend for Juventus was David Trezeguet, who's been out for most of the season with knee tendon damage, and he scored his first goal since coming back. I mean, I don't imagine he'll start against Chelsea. I would have thought you're going to be looking at Amaury and Del Piero up front.
Del Piero.
And I mean, Juventus obviously have played well enough at times this season to have some confidence in them. But, you know, again, they are on that questionable run. James is making some very elaborate hand gestures.
This is a set piece.
I see.
A traditional bête noir of the Chelsea bat line. And a bit of a speciality of the young lad, Del Piero.
I wouldn't have given Chelsea a hope in this tie now, but Drogba sort of showed signs that he's rousing from his slumber at the weekend. So if he can get his, you know, game face on, they'd have a chance.
Plus, Juve struggled against English sides in the last few years. Lost to Arsenal a couple of years ago, and lost to Liverpool last season. So they've got a bit of a psychological wall to overcome.
How much research have you been doing?
This is why I shouldn't be allowed to have half an hour preparation time, because I come out with all these pointless facts that don't go anywhere.
Right. What else have you got there?
Let's have a look. Arsene Wenger managed Monaco to victory over Roma in the Cup Winners' Cup in 1991-92.
Right. You see, that puts things in a different perspective. Very nice. The disturbingly named Lovejoy legend says, "Hey, AC Jimbo or Paolo, I was wondering if I could get your opinion on Gianpaolo Pazzini. I noticed he scored for Samp at the weekend. I always thought of him as a very exciting player. For some reason, he never hit it off at Fiorentina. Any reason for this? Briefly, Paolo."
He's playing better. I mean, I don't think that he's necessarily had a great season so far. He's a strong player. I don't think he necessarily has the finesse or touch that you might want from someone to really sort of be a top level striker. He is still young, you know. We'll see. I think he hasn't scored that many goals this season. He scored a small handful.
Isn't his big problem at Fiorentina? Or wasn't his big problem at Fiorentina Mutu and Gilardino?
Well, Gilardino only arrived this season, so he got. He was shipped out. But yes, I mean, last season he was given quite a lot of chances at Fiorentina and didn't really look.
Never lived up to that incredible under-21 game, which he's still known for. Okay, well, more previews, etc., at guardian.co.uk. But that brings us to the end of part one. You'll notice, of course, that there's plenty of Champions League talk that we haven't covered yet. We'll be tackling some of that and loads more besides in a second or two.
Football. Football Weekly from Guardian.co.uk with James Richardson.
Also on the Champions League agenda this week, Real Madrid hosting Liverpool, for whom it looks like it's all over in the league, unless they can win at Old Trafford, but that's a subject for another day. They had yet another draw at home, this time to Man City this weekend. Now they face a Real Madrid team that has suddenly produced a scorcher of a match with a 6-1 victory over Real Betis. Sid Lowe is at Madrid's training ground, which must be a happy place at the moment, Sid.
It is. It's an extremely cocky place at the moment. Everyone's very, very pleased with the way things are going. Obviously, they're very pleased in terms of the Spanish. They've now cut the gap to Barcelona, with Barcelona to 7 points at the top of the table, which they believe is now recoverable in a way that obviously Liverpool don't believe that 7 points is recoverable, because the dynamic here is different. Madrid are definitely improving, whereas Liverpool are definitely getting worse. And not only that, there's also the feeling about this Champions League game now. They've seen Liverpool play over the last few weeks and not been impressed. They've seen Real Madrid play over the last few weeks and been very, very impressed. So this side that was getting results, but getting results 1-0, 2-0, the occasional sort of scraped result, and not looking that impressive, is suddenly scoring the goals as well that were lacking before, and Madrid do look very strong right now.
How come they suddenly turned it on? Because it was 1-0 here, 1-0 there, and suddenly this 6-1 eruption.
Well, the curious thing in a way is that the last two games, they won 6-1 this weekend against Betis, 4-0 the weekend before against Sporting Gijón, and both of those games were about Aaron Robben. Now, we'd all been going on and on and on about Real Madrid being Robben reliant, as in, you know, dependent on Aaron Robben, not the car with the three wheels. But they've been talking about them being completely dependent on Robben, and you know, he was a key player. He goes out, and suddenly they invent other ways of creating chances. They invent other ways of scoring goals. I think in both cases, to be honest, they've been aided by really awful defences. But you don't score 10 goals by awful defences alone. And bit by bit, they're starting to find their feet. They're starting to kind of get used to the way that each other plays, and it's all flowing that little bit better. I think one or two key players that are worth talking about, though. One is Sergio Ramos, who looks really strong and powerful, and looks like the marauding right back he was a couple of years ago. He's finally got his fitness back again. I think he's been really, really important. And Lassana Diarra from Portsmouth has been brilliant since he came to Spain.
Interesting. And Klaus-Jan Huntelaar scoring a couple as well, I noticed on the weekend. What do you think of Liverpool's chances then? Obviously, Rafa Benitez is familiar with the setup there.
Yeah, very familiar. And of course, Rafa Benitez has spent almost half of his life at Real Madrid. He was a lad. He trained at Real Madrid before a knee injury pretty much ruined his career at the age of 19. He was a coach at Real Madrid, got to the stage where he was even first-team coach alongside Vicente del Bosque for 11 games back in 1994. So he does know this club. His preparation and research, Rafa Benitez, whatever else you say about him, is always absolutely impeccable. And with Real Madrid, will be no different. I think it will be close. And I think both coaches know each other very well. They're both quite analytical the way they go about things. They're both convinced more than anything else that the key is not conceding goals. I think they are to some extent same cloth. So I think we're going to see a very, very tight game. But right now it's difficult to see Liverpool getting through. But for one thing, of course, and you look back on the last few years, and Liverpool have been in a semi-final, a final, and they've won it.
Sid, Barcelona against Lyon. Again, when the draw was made, probably everybody thought that's an easy foregone conclusion. Now, has the dynamic changed as well because of recent events for Barcelona?
Yeah, tell us about those recent events as well, Sid, the incredible derby result.
Yeah, the derby result this weekend, absolutely stunning. Bear in mind that Espanyol hadn't beaten Barcelona at the Camp Nou in 27 years. Never, I really do like this stat, never in the Spanish league ever had the team that was bottom beaten the team that was top away from home. That happened this weekend. Espanyol beat Barcelona 2-1. These are two sides, as I say, that there were 42 points between them at the start of the match, the longest gap between two teams ever in a derby, in any match, in fact, in Spanish football history. And Espanyol beat them, but it's not just that they beat them. There's a feeling now that something is not quite right at Barcelona. Now, as you can imagine, the Madrid press have been talking up the fact that Barcelona weren't going to collapse for ages, and it looked very much like they're clutching at straws. But it does seem to be something ever so slightly more tangible about it now. You know, I wouldn't say that Barcelona are a bad side by any means, but there are one or two things that are not quite going right. They've still got fantastic players. They're still playing very, very good football most of the time. But you look at their recent results. They had to fight back to beat Osasuna 3-2. They drew 2-2 with Betis. They needed a bit of a helping hand from the referee to beat Numancia, which wasn't a great result. They now have been beaten by Espanyol. And it just, I think they might be a little tired. They've had a month when they've been playing a game every 3 or 4 days. And I think that could well be starting to cost them a little bit, because they very small squad.
Sid, am I right in thinking that Barcelona, they've only lost two league games this season, and that's to the teams who are currently bottom and second from bottom?
That's exactly right, yeah. They lost the first game of the season against Numancia, away at Numancia. Numancia are currently bottom. They just lost the second one against Espanyol, who are second bottom. Obviously were bottom when they faced each other because they're now second bottom because of those 3 points. And Espanyol were interesting because they're the first team this season, I think, to really go for Barcelona, to be aggressive, to set the game up into the other half of the pitch. And that may well be significant, but there are extenuating factors. One is that Barcelona had a player sent off, ludicrous decision from the referee. And the other is that Espanyol were filthy all the way through, diving, wasting time, a little bit of cheating, going at the referee. But it worked. And I think that may well send a message out to other teams that if you want to beat Barcelona, you've basically got to really, really pressure them all over the pitch and get aggressive with them.
So Lyon, they will have watched that game. What is your feeling now? Has the dynamic changed?
Yeah, they will have watched that game. Now, my feeling is that they will think Barca are a little bit easier than they previously were. I'd like to think that Lyon will have done, you know, their research well enough to have already known that Barcelona you have to be aggressive with, you have to close off space, you have to make sure they can't get through you. But of course, what's happened this season is that most teams have been very defensive. Eventually, Barcelona find a way through because they do have so much talent. But I think Lyon, one thing that Espanyol did that maybe Lyon can learn from is Espanyol put pressure on the Barca defence. Other teams haven't done that. They've sat back, they said to Barca, you can have the ball, but we're going to deny you space near our goal. What Espanyol did was they went, hang on, these defenders are not that hot with the ball at their feet. Let's go and put pressure on them. And so I wonder if Lyon might do that. They might step the whole pitch up, the whole game up a little bit.
The question I was going to ask, which is far more interesting, was Sergio Aguero and Giannina Maradona had a son last week. Now, I think his name is Benjamin, and Jimbo seems to think it's Lionel.
I think his name is Aguero. Not Aguera.
Sorry.
In Spain, of course, I think we talked about this in the pod not long ago, didn't we? About the surnames. You get both surnames, so that kid will be called Maradona Aguero.
Yeah, but
believe
the first
Benjamin.
Name, Sid. What's the first name?
I think it's Benjamin, yeah.
Benjamin. Oh, okay.
So you were wrong.
Barry's right, I'm wrong.
Internet hoax. Yeah. All right.
Excellent. Well, that's nice then. Best wishes to them. Well, that's excellent then. And the other games involving Spanish sides, Villarreal take on the Panathinaikos team, who actually topped Group B ahead of Inter Milan in the group stages. Atletico Madrid, their new coach Abel Resino, probably pronounced that wrong, welcoming two-time European champions Porto. So we'll speak to you soon, Sid.
Good stuff.
Thank you very much.
Hi.
Excellent. Sid Lowe there. Quick look at some posts. Let's see. Twernstrom sends us a love letter from America. That's nice. He has two questions. Why is Portsmouth referred to as Pompey? John, I don't know why I think you might know this.
I don't know why you think I might know this. Is it not
the town is known as Pompey as well, isn't it?
Yeah. I do not know. That's a very good question.
Well, thanks, Twernstrom. Yeah. and why does Wenger get a pass despite Arsenal's less than stellar season thus far? Todd, or Twernstrom, don't know where you were earlier on in the season, but Wenger has not been getting a pass, I think, from anyone.
Certainly not by the Arsenal fans.
No.
It's never been this loud in a stadium.
So, yes. I think that, the knives, if not being out, are at least being located in the cutlery drawer. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, Champions League. Stilton says, after repeated prompting and badgering, the pod crew finally named their three choices for relegation from the Premier League a couple of weeks ago. My question today is a bit simpler. Who's going to win the Champions League? There are only 16 teams to choose from. It should be pretty straightforward. Do any of you see a team not called Barcelona triumphing in Istanbul in May? I don't, because it's in Rome. The final, Stilton, who sees, he says, Chelsea. He thinks that Hiddink, legendary motivator and tactician, will pull all the egos together into a team for this competition and they will win it. Well, we touched on this. Do you think Hiddink's effect, given that he's gone in May, is going to be that big? If he's going to be gone in May?
Yeah, well, I mean, Avram Graham was always going to be gone in May and he had a decent record. I don't think that the effect of Hiddink as such is going to make the big difference. I think they needed a change from Scolari,
right.
I think. Almost
didn't
anyone.
Didn't matter who came in.
Yeah.
Interesting. Tony Adams, even, do you think?
Well, I mean, right. We have to draw the line.
Portlander has a related question, a question for the experts. Statistically speaking, does hiring a big-name manager actually get the desired result? Do big-name managers stay in their jobs longer? Do their teams end up in a better position 1 year after the big name is hired? How about 2 years, 3 years? I look forward to hearing the answers in the next pod. John.
Well, obviously, there's been a great deal of research into big name managers, and they have found that depending on how big the name is, if a name is bigger than 10 on the big name scale.
Right.
They say, win 43%.
How many letters can it have in it before it constitutes
a big name? My name has 11 letters, my surname, so I would probably be an excellent manager.
Portland, I apologise. I thought John was going to take that seriously. Do big name managers, are they worth a...
What's a big name manager, though? That's what I don't...
Well,
do you not think it might be an idea that next time we get a question like that, you could sort of warn us in advance so that we could...
Anyone who's in on... I don't know who's in on Thursday, but we'll heads up on that. And Portland, if you want to stop by again on Thursday...
Did he send us in capitals, this letter?
No, he didn't. There you go. If you, Portlander, want to get in touch again, as you know, you just have to go to guardian.co.uk/football, or you can visit us on Facebook. Anybody who has thoughts are there on that big name issue. But there you go. That's it for part two. Still to come, excitingly enough, on Football Weekly, Raphael Honigstein unveils or opens a can of Bundesliga excitements for us, and John Ashdown talks us through the Championship, which is looking very intriguing indeed. Super duper. Now, Champions League midweek, Sporting Club de Portugal, who just come off a 3-2 derby victory over Benfica, as you know, are going to be hosting FC Bayern München, who've been beaten in 3 of their last 4 games, it says here. Basically, since you tipped them, since Christmas, it's all gone horrifically wrong.
They've been absolutely, well, I wouldn't say absolutely appalling, but they've been pretty poor, and now they've probably had the worst game of the season at home to Cologne. And lost 2-1. But there is a sense of, you know, all this lingering, these lingering doubts about Klinsmann that was sort of had pushed, been aside just before the winter break because they went on a good run. And now coming back, you hear about players complaining that the tactics are wrong. I mean, even publicly, Philipp Lahm has said now on the record maybe 5 times, we are playing without any defensive cover. This can't go on. And he's saying it week in, week out, and nothing changes. And he really is very, very annoyed.
A note of alarm, quite literally, there.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, I got it.
And eventually.
Yeah. you know, there's also sorts of issues. I mean, Klinsmann brought in Landon Donovan from the MLS, from the Galaxy. That was his dream player, one player he wanted. He's been absolute rubbish. The board have said, sorry, Klinsmann, you're not having this. He's going back beginning of March. He's on a loan deal, just like Beckham. And that's obviously hasn't really done anything for his authority or his standing with the other players, because they now really question his judgment if he brings in a guy like this who's clearly not good enough. And they needed a third striker because... Podolski's been injured for quite a while, and he's just come back but was absolutely rubbish as well. So there's all this discontent brewing, and I think they're one bad result on Wednesday night away from a major crisis, because Klinsmann has come in with all these promises of improving the team, not only in Germany but especially in the Champions League, where they feel they haven't been really pulling their weight in recent years. And if he and, you know, the group stage were good enough, but if they were, God forbid, knocked out by Sporting, by a team that they regard as a lesser side, it's all going to kick off in Munich, and Klinsmann might not see out the year.
Oh, well, there you go. Now, just on the whole issue of the Bundesliga, is it now officially the most exciting league in Europe? Because you've actually got more than one, a bit like the SPL, I guess, more than one team that might win the title.
You've got 6 teams, I think, who are realistically in the run. I mean, Wolfsburg have only 6 points less than league leaders Hamburg. It's a typical situation that we've seen also in 2007 when Bayern lost their way a little bit, finished 4th. All of a sudden, all the others come in and the league becomes very open. And it's brilliant because you've got a real mix. You've got Hamburg, who haven't won anything in 25 years. You've got Hoffenheim, who've never won anything, full stop. You've got sort of the fallen giants in there with Bayern. And new and up and coming, well, not new, but up and coming teams who are backed by companies, Leverkusen and Wolfsburg. So it's a very interesting mix. And there were some amazing storylines from this weekend, just briefly. I mean, Stuttgart-Hoffenheim was one of the most incredible matches that you're ever going to, you're ever likely to see. It was 3-3. Hoffenheim missed a penalty in extra time, in injury time. And Jens Lehmann was on his maddest best behaviour. He when Salihovic, the Hoffenheim midfielder, lost a shoe after a tackle just outside the box, Lehmann dashed out, picked up the shoe, and threw it behind his goal where it landed on top of the goal net. So Salihovic had to come off, climb up sort of the goal net and take his shoe back because he wasn't allowed. If you carry on with one shoe, you get a yellow card. And he was already on a yellow card.
So,
and he then missed his penalty
a few minutes
later. So Lehmann
was actually trying to get him a yellow card, was he?
Well, Lehmann claimed that he took away the shoe because he didn't want anyone stepping on it or he didn't want a shot being deflected from it. And he always does. He said, I always look after my box and make sure there's nothing in my line of vision. But it was very odd. And Rangnick said afterwards, you know, I've always had a lot of respect for Jens Lehmann, but I think this is unsporting conduct and should have warranted a yellow card. There was so much going on that this wasn't even the main talking point because 1 hour before the game, it emerged that two Hoffenheim players 2 weeks ago were 10 minutes late for the doping test. And they were late for the very same reason that the two guys at Brescia were late, because the manager had ordered them in for a team talk straight after the whistle. It went on for 10 minutes. They came in and now they've got the authorities on their back, and Hoffenheim are really worried that these two guys are going to be suspended for a whole year, which is the precedent in the Brescia case.
Yeah,
so it's an unbelievable story. And Gladbach, who they played, who they drew 1-1 with, of course, are fighting against relegation and have come in with an official complaint now as well.
It's an extraordinary case, actually, which we've never even touched on here. There's even been a strike, a classic strike that they do in Italy, where they kick games off 15 minutes late as a sign of protest because of these two players who, largely through no fault of their own, have just ended up on the wrong side of the...
Of Vardar's stick.
Exactly, of Vardar's stick. It's not like Rio Ferdinand where they didn't turn up. They just turned up late.
All four of the players concerned tested negative, the two Italians at Brescia and the Hoffenheim players. But these are the new regulations that have come into force this season,
which basically match football to other sports around the place.
And, so, you know, as a player, you even now have to let them know your whereabouts for the next 30 days ahead, I think. Yeah. So it's quite draconian. And you feel that perhaps Rangnick wasn't quite aware just... how strict the new regime is. But it's an incredible story.
And one that I think is going to come to... there's a crunch that we're heading towards there, I think, between the Football Authority and certainly the Players' Union and WADA over this, because it doesn't seem to be a practicable arrangement. Amazing stuff. Thank you, Raphael, for that. Have you got any more crazy stories from the Bundesliga, the world's most exciting league?
Yeah, there is one more crazy story. Most Frankfurt fans for the away game at Karlsruhe turned up in orange. Now, orange is obviously connected with the Dutch team, so it's never really been popular for German fans as such. Not part of the coat of arms or colours of the club. But one of the major ultra groups call themselves the Droogs, and they reference Cockwork Orange, etc. So they said, we are going to this game in orange, and about 3,000 people came in orange, then started lighting Bengal flares, whatever, and then started shooting flares onto the pitch. One of them nearly missed the Karlsruhe keeper.
You mean nearly hit the Karlsruhe keeper?
Well, yes. Well, it narrowly missed,
okay. Yes.
And at which point the referee called the game off for 5 minutes, took everyone to the dressing room, they came out again, and now there's a big debate about the ultras and, you know, are they good for football? Are they really just doing their own thing, not unconnected to the club? Because they were clearly hurting Frankfurt's chances, who actually ended up winning that game. So that's another big developing story, especially on a weekend where at the derby between Schalke and Dortmund, 127 people were arrested for fighting.
Really? Mm.
It's all kicking off in the Bundesliga.
Yeah. The Championship, John Ashdown.
I hope he has some top anecdotes. The pressure is very much on.
Absolutely. Things have really turned around there. The three teams that were running away with it, now they've come and given it back, haven't they?
Well, yeah, yes and no. It is a ridiculous sort of clown car of a division, and we've sort of reached the point now where the doors have fallen off. Since Christmas, Wolves, Birmingham, Reading are the runaway leaders and have been pretty much all season. But since Christmas, all three really have been in dire form. Wolves have picked up only 8 points in the 10 games since Christmas. Birmingham have won twice since Boxing Day, picking up 13. And Reading have only picked up 10 points in the 8 games. So Wolves, if the league had started at Christmas, Wolves, who are still the leaders, would be just outside the relegation zone. the reason that it's not quite the exciting
not like the Bundesliga.
Development. No, it's not like the Bundesliga. Is that the chasing pack aren't so much a chasing pack as a sort of group ambling in vaguely the same direction. Well, for example, at Christmas, Wolves were 13 points clear of the fourth place team, which at the time was Burnley. And despite having won only once since Christmas, they're now 11 points clear of the fourth place team. So they've only actually lost 2 points. I mean, that's a slightly misleading stat because Cardiff have got 4 games in hand now.
And, 4?
Yeah, they've got 4 games because of postponements and FA Cup commitments, right, and what have you. Yeah, and if they win those, they'd be level on points with Wolves.
Right.
But they won't. So
the team's behind because you've got Wolves, Birmingham, Reading still the top three. And Reading are 6 points clear of Bristol City. And a further point behind Bristol City, who beat Reading, actually, at the weekend, I read here.
Mm-hmm. Well, Reading were scoring goals for fun and seem to have just lost. They haven't scored in several games now, I think. Is that
yeah,
right?
I think they've got one in the last five. That's partly due to Steve Coppell's insistence on playing the two central midfielders are both sort of defensively orientated, which puts a lot of pressure on the wingers. And Jimmy Keeby, who plays on one side on the right, is very hit and miss anyway. And Stephen Hunt, who plays on the other, has not been the same player since the rumours about his departure in January to Premier League teams. So they're just they're struggling to actually create chances for the forward players. And Kevin Doyle, who still got 17 goals this season, so he's still one of the top scorers in the league, has only scored twice since November, I think. So yeah, the goals have certainly dried up there.
And so, who do you see coming in from? Do you think any of the teams that, whether it's Bristol City, Preston, Cardiff, Sheffield, Burnley, even can they break into the promotion places?
I still think, despite the growing evidence to the contrary, that the top three are still the best three teams in the league. They've all got the same problem. I mean, I think Wolves' problem is, if you look at the age of their players at the weekend, the 14 players that played are aged 22, 24, 33. That's Jody Craddock, who's the only sort of senior player. 24, 23, 23, 26, 23, 22, 22, 21, 21 and 19. It's an incredibly young team who've got no real experience of getting over the finish line. So I think the sort of nerves of being the outright leaders for so long is beginning to kick in. But they're still a very, very decent side, I think. And I think they will come out of it and still win the league.
Interesting. Nice one, John. Thanks very much for that. Just before we go, I realised that that post from Stilton, which I managed to avoid answering, we should have a quick pop at answering. He was the chap saying, who do we think is going to win the Champions League? So before the extra evidence comes in from the midweek games, do we all want to have a pop at naming a winner for this year's Champions League? John Ashdown?
I'll say Manchester United.
Rafael Honigstein.
I'll say Real Madrid.
Interesting.
This week, I shall say Juventus.
Really?
Yes.
That's a lovely choice. And I myself will say, sadly, Manchester United. I mean, all credit to them and that. And best wishes to all their supporters.
If they avoid defeat this week, they'll set a new record for undefeated games in the Champions League.
Really?
How many games
will that be?
It'll be 20 games since they last tasted defeat. But that last defeat was in the San Siro against Milan in 2007.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to go and predict that three English sides will crash out of Big Cup in this round.
And which three will they be? Or which one will survive?
I think Liverpool will survive.
Wow. Aren't you a contrary one?
Well, we'll see. I'm probably completely wrong, but I might be right. And then I can be smug.
Well, if you want to catch Barry being smug or chastened by his errant call, then do join us, as I hope you will be doing, Barry, on Thursday.
I think so, yeah.
All right, excellent. Football Weekly Extra. We'll be looking back on the midweek Champions League games, probably having a quick cursory nod to the UEFA Cup games on Thursday. There is some interesting little fixtures there. And, of course, looking forward to what the weekend holds around this grand continent of Europe. In the meantime, many, many thanks, John Ashdown.
Thank you.
For joining us today. Paolo Bandini, who was beamed down some hours ago. And Rafael Honigstein.
Thank you.
Excellent stuff from you, Rafael. Great stories. And Barry Glendinning and producer Pete. And you, the listener, will be back on Thursday. Hope to speak to you then.